Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we were just talking about President Obama with Slate Chief Political Correspondent John Dickerson, and we are going to have a State of the Union watching party here on January 25th. We'll tell you details of that as it comes closer. But parents, we want your children's help for this State of the Union watching party. That's right. Answer this question on our politics website, It's a Free Country. Actually, have your kids answer this question. If you were president, what would you say to the country? We want your kids to answer that question. Will you engage them in this when they come home from school? Tisk, 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 no snow day today. Write a story, long or short, silly or serious, and send it to us. A few of the stories, here's the payoff. A few of the stories will be performed live on the night of the speech by the Story Pirates. That's the local comedy troupe that takes stories written by kids and turns them into musical sketches. So parents, get your kids to do this, and maybe your child's story about what the president should say to the country will be performed live at the Green Space on the night of the State of the Union address. To find out more details and submit your child's story, just go to our politics website. It's a freecountry.org. The deadline for submissions is next Tuesday. CNN terrorism and national security correspondent Peter Bergen is with us now. He's one of very few journalists to have actually interviewed Osama bin Laden. And in this 10th year since the 9/11 attacks, he has written a comprehensive history of the war on terror, reporting on both the U.S. and al-Qaeda perspectives. It's called The Longest War, The Enduring Conflict Between America and al-Qaeda. Hi, Peter. Welcome back to WNYC.
Brian, thank you for the invitation.
And one of the things in this book is that you argue that nearly 10 years on, it still matters that the United States get Osama bin Laden. People have written that off as a priority. Why do you think it matters?
Well, I think particularly we're sitting here in downtown Manhattan. I mean, I don't think anybody listening to the show has any illusion that it isn't important as a matter of justice for the victims of 9/11 to find the guy who was the intellectual author of the attacks. But there are other reasons in addition. He is the if you look at court transcripts of many people involved in al-Qaeda or allied groups, many of the people involved will say that bin Laden was their inspiration. So he's also the inspiration of the global jihadist movement. And he's also the leader of al-Qaeda. And al-Qaeda is led by an inspirational, charismatic leader. When you join al-Qaeda, you don't pledge an oath of allegiance to al-Qaeda. You pledge an oath of allegiance to bin Laden.
Really?
Similar to what when you join the Nazi Party, of course, the Nazi Party and al-Qaeda are very, very different animals. But they do share the similarity that you swore an oath of allegiance to Adolf Hitler. And so this is organizations that are, you know, dominated by charismatic leaders, if you take the charismatic leader out, the organization tends to fade.
And yet you report in the book about bin Laden companions in arms who have turned against him. Is there deep factionalism within al-Qaeda at this point?
Well, al-Qaeda has always been a small organization, but it is certainly a fact that quite a number of people who weren't necessarily part of al-Qaeda but have known bin Laden for decades, fought with him in Afghanistan, also some of his religious mentors have turned against him publicly. And I think this is one of the most underreported stories of the last several years because it's very commonplace. Even relatively educated people in the United States will say, well, Muslims aren't doing enough to speak up against al-Qaeda, Muslim leaders. In fact, that is totally untrue. A few days after 9/11, we had major Muslim clerics condemning 9/11. But what is new, certainly in the last 2 or 3, 4 years, is guys who are real jihadis who fought against, they're not just Muslim clerics, but they're people who took up arms, or they're people who are militant clerics who may have spent, who are actually very anti-American in many cases. But they have turned against bin Laden. And that is a very big deal because when you lose the people that gave you the ideological ballast or the kind of militant, who have this militant history, it's very hard for al-Qaeda to say these guys are just government Muslim clerics or that they're not serious.
Does that mean they've turned against the whole idea of violent jihad?
Depends who they are, but that's a very good question, Brian, because a lot of these guys will say, well, the jihad in Iraq was a legitimate one. And in fact, from a Quranic point of view, it is, because when a non-Muslim country invades under uncertain legal
authority,
a a Muslim country, it certainly would fit in the Quran that it's a kind of defensive jihad is admissible. But anyway, so these guys are not necessarily. Look, I mean, the other thing also, it was very naive for us to believe that the United States is like, we should win the war of ideas by saying the United States is the world's greatest country. We may feel that, but lots of other people in the world don't feel that. We're going to win the war of ideas against al-Qaeda because they're going to lose the war of ideas, just as the Soviets did, not because, you know, communism, which is a bad set of ideas, that imploded of its own badness over time, and al-Qaeda is not dissimilar in that.
And so do you think that the idea of violent jihad is growing or shrinking since 9/11, or has it gone through peaks and valleys?
And it kind of depends which part of the world you're in. I mean, look, in Pakistan, right, we've had this terrible political assassination, which is very similar to the assassination of Benazir Bhutto, where the governor of Punjab, the leading, arguably one of the most important political posts in the country, was assassinated by his bodyguard, who, because he merely suggested that he was opposed to these blasphemy laws in Pakistan, which are often used against minorities by people just who are settling petty vendettas.
He wasn't politically religious enough.
Right. So, you know, and what's really, there was an extraordinary story by Carlotta Gall in the New York Times yesterday. Many of the lawyers who were instrumental in getting rid of the military dictator Musharraf are also showering petals on the guy who assassinated this secular politician. And so it goes to this whole question of a generation in Pakistan which has been really infected with these ideas that are, quite dangerous.
Do you think that Pakistan or parts of Pakistan are being radicalized because of the U.S. response to 9/11 or for more independent reasons?
Well, long before 9/11, I mean, General Zia, who was the military dictator in Pakistan in the 1980s, put a lot of laws on the books which are quite disturbing. To give you one example, if you get raped in Pakistan as a woman and you can't provide the four men who are supposed to be witnesses to the rape, which is in the, you know, sort of a Quranic idea, then you must have had sex outside of marriage, so then you're prosecuted for adultery. And that is the sort of thing that General Zia brought in the 1980s. So this kind of radicalization of Pakistani society long preceded our response on 9/11.
Do you think that capturing bin Laden is an Obama administration priority?
Of course it is. They don't talk about it a lot because, you don't win much if you keep saying, hey, it's a big priority, and then nothing happens. And also it has the unintended consequence of making him more important than he should be. But there are plenty of people in the U.S. government get up every morning thinking about how to find bin Laden. Problem is that there aren't many good ideas right now.
More than 100,000 people have died in Afghanistan and Iraq. Al-Qaeda has struck Spain and England and Bali and more. Why haven't we captured bin Laden yet?
Well, this is not an exact analogy, but it took the Israelis 15 years to find Eichmann in Latin America, not for a lack of desire to find Eichmann. And so finding people is tricky, particularly if they're not making the kinds of errors that get you caught. Typically, criminals go and hide, go to their mother's house, or they call their family. And I mean, bin Laden is not doing these kinds of things. And so, it is. On the other hand, I don't want to excuse, this is a big failure. And we spent $500 billion on our intelligence agency since 9/11. And this really basic question, which after all the war was about at the end of the day, has not been answered, which was bringing bin Laden to justice.
Peter Bergen, CNN terrorism correspondent, author of The Longest War, The Enduring Conflict Between America and Al-Qaeda. You write that senior Bush administration officials lied about the story of bin Laden in the Battle of Tora Bora in 2001. What was the lie and what really happened?
Well, let's be charitable. Let's say it wasn't a lie. They pretended they didn't know something, which was, after all, very important. The Battle of Tora Bora is when we had bin Laden surrounded. And in the very closely contested 2004 presidential election, Vice President Cheney and President Bush said, we didn't know if bin Laden was at the Battle of Tora Bora. It's hard to tell which is worse. Were they prevaricating, or did they not know about the details of the most important battle of the war on terror hitherto? And this, after all, World Trade Center was still a smoking ruin 3 months after 9/11. I mean, this was all very fresh. The fact that they I think it defies credit. It defies. You'd have to be very creditless to say that they didn't know. There's all sorts of contemporary information I point out in the book that they were aware that Bin Laden was a Tora Bora, but they just, because John Kerry was using this as an important election kind of theme, they kept saying that Kerry was mistaken or lying himself, and of course that has turned out to be wrong.
You said before that Al-Qaeda is actually a very small organization. What is Al-Qaeda at this point?
Well, Al-Qaeda is probably a relatively small. I mean, the head of the National Counterterrorism Center there said there are probably 350 members of Al-Qaeda in Pakistan right now. But getting kind of Al-Qaeda was a very small organization on 9/11 and inflicted a great deal of damage on the United States. And you look at the Baader-Meinhof gang in Germany in the 1970s. This was, you know, maybe a couple of dozen people, inflicted a great deal of damage on German society. So focusing only on the numbers and sort of saying, well, there aren't that many of them, so what's the big deal, is I think, misguided.
But people have said for years that Al-Qaeda, more than an organization, is really an idea at this point, an idea that has some resonance in Muslim communities or radicalized fringes of Muslim communities in various nations.
It does, unfortunately. You know, there's a kind of Bin Ladenism is not communism. I mean, there aren't millions of people who adhere to this idea. But Bin Laden, there are enough people around the Muslim world. See, what Bin Laden's genius is, was able to produce a single narrative about all problems. So if you're a British Muslim living in Britain, it's not British racial discrimination that is your problem. It's because Muslims around the world are under attack. And that explains why you may not be getting social advancement or whatever. And if you're, you know, some guy living in Minneapolis who's from a Somali background, you know, you see your brethren in Somalia, and Bin Laden has put it in this larger frame of a, you know, Christian conspiracy to destroy Islam, and particularly led by the United States. And so Bin Laden, I mean, there's no doubt that, you know, Bin Laden's Al-Qaeda is one thing that Bin Laden created, but this ideology is a much larger thing that he's created. The good news is that fewer and fewer people around the Muslim world are buying into this. I mean, support for suicide bombing is just cratering in most Muslim countries. Admiration for Bin Laden is going down, although he still retains some kind of credibility.
Why do you call your book The Longest War?
It's really just simply an accurate portrayal of what is the longest war the United States is engaged in. I mean, there's some debate about how long the Vietnam War lasted. Some people might say from 63 to 72. And however you slice it, you know, we're already into a decade of this war. And we know that we'll be in Afghanistan until December 2014. And it's just the longest war we've engaged in. It's not the most significant one, certainly. You know, we faced an existential threat from the Soviets and an existential threat, in some senses, from the Nazis. And I don't want to claim that this war is existential.
And in the Civil War, if you want to go back.
Right. But this is, you know, I think when historians will look back on this period and say, I wish this was our biggest problem today, because in the scale of human history, this is a problem, but it's not an existential one by any stretch.
Still, this is not like defeating Japan or Germany. How do we know when this war is over?
I think when you don't book me on the show. I mean, which is maybe a facetious way of putting it. I mean, when it's no longer a subject of public discussion, it is not going to go away, but it will just fade.
Frequency of attacks.
Frequency of attacks. You know, this ideology. Ideologies burn themselves out. We don't really concern ourselves. Marxist-Leninism is not something that lots of people around the world are particularly interested in adhering to now.
For better and for worse, I think we will have Peter Bergen to kick around a few more times on this program. His new book is called The Longest War, The Enduring Conflict Between America and Al-Qaeda. He is CNN's national security correspondent. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And when we come back in a minute, the caveman diet. Why do they call it that? Because there's some science, or at least a theory, that says our bodies evolved before the advent of farming. So what does that mean we should eat? Stay with us.